We provided something different in the sense that a number of the trainees on the traineeship program, you know, would get work experience here in Speedtrack first before we would send them out to industry, because again, you know, work needed to be done with people before they could go out to industry partners, and we wanted those people to have the best opportunity maybe to secure a job.
Welcome to the From Passion to Action podcast, a discussion about social innovation and social entrepreneurship from Dublin City University. I'm Dr. Eimear Ní Bhriodi.
I'm Donica Kinlan.
And I'm Mita Power. In this series, we talk to academic experts in social innovation and entrepreneurship, social entrepreneurs who have founded their own social enterprises, and community organizations that are contributing to meaningful social change.
The aim of these conversations is to delve into the concepts of social innovation and entrepreneurship in theory and in practice, to discuss why they are important in today's society, and above all, to explore ways to embed these concepts in higher education across different disciplines.
The From Passion to Action project is based at Dublin City University and funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. We hope that you enjoy sharing these materials as well with your colleagues and with your students. Today we're having a conversation with John Murphy, CEO of Speedpack. John, you're very welcome today. Before we introduce Speedpack, we'd like to start with a few questions of about social innovation and social entrepreneurship. So our first question for you today is, what's the first word that you think of when you hear the concepts social innovation and social entrepreneurship?
I think, hello, Eimear and Mita as well. How are you? I suppose that's a difficult one to put into one word, a tricky one, but I think of sort of better world is the sort of, if I can use two words, I think about things around people and planet and profit, but really a better world is really what I'm thinking. That's what comes to mind. I mean, for social innovation, to come back to that notion of people, planet, profit, I mean, it is, when you do think about anything that we are doing in this space, it is about creating a more equitable and a much fairer society is ultimately what it's about, and providing opportunities maybe to people who ordinarily wouldn't maybe get some of the opportunities that are out there. And I like to think of it as kind of rebalancing, you know, where I suppose opportunities are. It's very much about, I suppose, as we know, about the kind of sustainability of our planet, and about looking at ways in which we do business in a better way. I think that's obviously such an important issue for all of us sharing this world. And then it's ultimately then about that kind of redistribution of, like, follow the money, where does the money go? And I suppose within that sort of space of social innovation, social enterprise, that sort of ecosystem, it is about where the motivation is. I mean, obviously we operate as businesses, but at the same time, and we need to be sustainable from a business perspective to do what we do. But it is really about reinvesting that money back in, and at the same time paying people a decent wage.
Okay, that's interesting. If you've touched on a few issues there, I'm interested in, how would you define a social enterprise as distinct from any other kind of enterprise?
Well, I mean, social enterprises are there. They're like any business, first of all. They're there, but they're there to, you know, satisfy a market need. But that market need is a social need, a social issue out there, to be satisfied in some way, to improve the quality of life for the people that it impacts on. So it's applying the same principle as any business would be set up. It's satisfying a market need, except in this instance, that market need happens to be a social issue, as opposed to maybe the development of a particular product or service, which is not necessarily dealing with maybe the sorts of issues that a social enterprise would deal with. But it's using business principles. So it is, to all intents and purposes, it is operating as a business to the outside world. It is behaving like a business. And I sometimes just kind of describe it in a way that, you know, sort of, we are similar to an SME, but you kind of look under the bonnet and what you see in it is more like the hybrid model. You're seeing that sort of, you know, commercial operation running alongside a whole series of other sort of maybe intervention supports programs that are showing the uniqueness of what we're doing and make us different as a social enterprise compared to a regular business.
Okay, and to some of our listeners who might come from a business background, an SME is a small to medium enterprise, small being up to 9 employees, medium being 10 to 50 employees. So you mentioned the using business principles and so on, but in an earlier thing you said, you talked about where the money goes and so on. In terms of the money invested in a social enterprise versus, let's call it, a for-profit enterprise, how would you see the differences there in terms of the money?
Well, I suppose it's probably good to give an example of our company, just for instance. So our board of directors, so the people that I would report into, are all voluntary directors. Voluntary sounds as if in some way that, you know, they're volunteering, of which they are, but they, you know, the same sort of conditions apply to a director of a company within our business. They don't get paid any remuneration. There's no shareholder dividends within the company. They're giving their time. In our instance, like, for example, they would have given 40 days of their time combined last year to the operation. So that's, you know, people, business leaders within the community or people in the local development and community sector also who are on our board giving their time back in. They don't get any expenses at all. So they're, you know, that's a massive difference in terms of, so when we're generating revenues, the money that's coming back into the organization is going to pay the core salaries of staff like myself and my colleagues within the team and core staffing. But it's also then plowed back into providing the opportunity. In our case, it's providing, you know, commercial work experience and industry-led training to people who have been previously long-term unemployed. So if you follow the money, as I said, it's not going to shareholders, it's going back into the organization. And I suppose, you know, again, even if you take, as we build up our, you know, we've got an asset here within the community. We're based here in Clonshock Business Park, which is not too far away from DCU. We're close enough to some very big companies that operate here, like Amazon and AbbVie, which was formerly Allergan and is actually one of our corporate sponsors as well. So we're operating within this space. But if, for example, we ever ceased to trade as an organization, any money that would be made from the selling of the building and anything would go back to a local development company. In fact, our founders, the Northside Partnership. And so that's where there's a sort of asset lock. So the resource is kept and any value that's generated goes back into the community, which we are here to serve, which is on Dublin's Northside.
Okay, I think that's very interesting about the directors and the remuneration that they don't get for the work that they do versus if they were directors of a for-profit organisation. But we've been talking a bit about SpeedPak, but we haven't actually explained what SpeedPak actually does under all these business principles. So can you introduce us to what SpeedPak does?
Yes, we call ourselves a trading, training and transforming organisation. So we trade commercially to transform the lives of people who were previously long-term unemployed through industry-led training and work experience. And, you know, we came about because within this community, I mean, we're here since 1995, so we're here a long time. We were founded by Northside Partnership, I mentioned earlier on, which is a local development company. We came into existence to solve a problem. And that problem was that this community experienced higher levels of long-term unemployment than many other communities in Dublin, but also nationally as well. So the rate of long-term unemployment was much higher. So we came to solve that problem, and that's why we were set up.
And what do you do other than provide employment to these people? What do they do?
Well, of course, and so what we do is then the trading part. So to solve the problem of long-term unemployment, we, at the time, I say we, the Northside Partnership, and when it came up with this concept, it came up, first of all, with the concept with the support of the organizations that were around the table in the Northside Partnership, the local development company. And you may be familiar, or some of the people listening to the podcast may be familiar with local development companies, but they're there to bring together, I suppose, the different players that are involved in the community, like the state, the business community, the community itself, and other interested parties together to solve issues that are affecting the local community. And in this instance, they looked at the problem of long-term unemployment. And it was felt that, like, you had this catch-22. How do you get work experience without a job? And how do you get a job without work experience? So it was to try and solve that issue. And it was through that kind of collaboration between those various partners that the concept came about, led by, at the time, the business community, and in particular, what was known as Cadbury's and is now Mondelez, came up with the concept of why not just create a real commercial business, because local people were finding it difficult to get work experience in regular businesses. This was seen as a way to bypass that, create an entity that to the outside world looks like a regular business, and allow people then to be employed in that business and then get the work experience, get the training. And as far as any other business would view it, if a person having worked with us moved on, they would see that they had commercial work experience, their CV would be updated, they would have got new skills, they would be moving from one job to another job, as opposed to being unemployed or long-term unemployed, moving into work. So that was the concept at the time. And it started off in a very sort of, a simple way to try and address that problem. And over the last 25 years, I suppose we've built on that offering, and we have adapted and hopefully improved along the way as we have got more experience and built our team as well within the company.
Okay, and I'm interested in these people who are long-term unemployed. I'm interested in their backgrounds and what it is they do when they come to work with Speedpack, or, you know, why are they long-term unemployed? You know, what's the typical employee that you train and transform through trading?
I suppose let's put this into, first of all, a little bit of context at the moment. I mean, unemployment has been with us, you know, it's always there, all right? And it moves from sometimes where you've got, the labour market is tight because the economy has grown. And we would have seen that up to a couple of years ago when the economy had grown quite significantly prior to the pandemic. And then what we had then was we had the pandemic, and now we are in a situation where we've got ultimately, you know, very high and potentially very high unemployment. We've got, you know, 6% of people are unemployed in the country at the moment. You include the PUP payment, and that's in excess of 20%. If you look at people aged between 15 and 24, who the ESRI have said, you know, have been the most impacted group, you're looking at in excess of 62% on the PUP payment. So we are as relevant now today as we were when we were first founded. And in fact, what tends to happen for us is that we point our resources and our offering to address, I suppose, the unemployment issue as it is at that particular time. So when the labor market is tight and we've got fewer people who are long-term unemployed, what you tend to find are unemployed, you tend to find those people are further back from the labor market. And what I mean by that is that there are more barriers for people to get a job who we would be supporting. So what you tend to find are the common sort of characteristics of somebody who is long-term unemployed. And again, it's not a homogenous group. So sometimes we kind of, these terms are bandied around. I don't like it because it kind of says, oh, if you say you're long-term unemployed, you're X, Y, and Z. It's not that. It's just that there are characteristics there. And I suppose some people have just maybe one of those, others have multiple. So what we're talking about are things like low formal education. So we would have a lot of people And at different times, we would have had up to 80% of our staff who would have had no leaving certificate. So the highest qualification they would have got would have been the junior cert or inter cert as it was prior to that. And we've got people then who might, as a result of that, maybe have some literacy difficulties, reading and writing difficulties. We have people who may have had a criminal conviction and are, that's the reason that they're out of work. But maybe there's other reasons then why they ended up being in prison is because actually they left school early, they got into trouble. They, you know, they may have, you know, dabbled with, unfortunately, with drugs, and there may have been issues there as well. There may be other reasons. People may have had a mental health issue for a period of time. People may have had some, or may have some form of disability. I mean, a person is out of work because they're, you know, they're out of work, but the reasons why they're out of work can be absolutely, you know, it's across a spectrum. And as I said, I should even say it could be because the economy, I mean, when the economy nosedived in 2008, 2009, you know, we had a massive range of talented people. I mean, everyone has talents, but I'm talking about people with real talent. I mean, who could get a job anytime, anywhere, but just couldn't get a job because there were no jobs out there. So our role is to keep people connected. For people who are just out of work, we want to stop them getting back into, you know, to lose touch with the labour market. And it doesn't take long for somebody to lose touch with, if you're out of work, you begin to lose your networks, they become diluted, you actually begin to lose your confidence, unless you're very, very resilient. For anyone who's been out of work for a period of time, you doubt yourself, some of your skills become, you know, outdated in some way, you feel. And it depends where your baseline is. If you've got a university degree with loads of experience, you know, your resilience and tolerance is much higher than somebody who loses a job, who maybe was very, very capable, but actually maybe went into that job with, you know, maybe a junior cert or something like that, which wouldn't have the same sort of currency with it. And so therefore, the starting point for people is very different. And that's why our starting point with people can sometimes be quite far back from where the market really might need them to be able to compete in the market. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to level the playing field, give people opportunities to come back to work, get them back into the business, get them turning up to work, okay? You've been out of work for a while, you get out of routines. It doesn't take long for that to happen. Turn up on time for work. Get to start meeting people again. Some people get very isolated as well. Meet, work in teams again. Begin then to learn new processes or skills or take part in the training that we have offered. And we've sort of have, you know, basic kind of offering, training offering, work experience and training offering, which is just getting people back into the routine of work, giving some basic training around maybe health and safety, personal development, that sort of stuff. And then we have at times then we also have then more, I suppose, advanced programs, different programs, which have a lot more resources. And that's because we're out there looking for, you know, corporate social type responsibility partnerships with companies or with philanthropy as well, and then we can put more resources into those opportunities for people as well.
Okay, it's very interesting. You've touched on a few issues there to do with the challenges that people who are long-term unemployed or low-skilled have, and it ties in an indirect way or maybe a direct way with my colleague Mida. Who has an interest and a background in occupational therapy. And I know you're curious about a few things, Mida, that you might like to discuss with John.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, John.
Hiya, Mida.
So as Eimear was saying, from an occupational therapy perspective, I'd be really interested in talking about SpeedPAC, I suppose, because with occupational therapy, at the core of it, I suppose, is the importance of being occupied and having purpose and role and a routine, as you mentioned, and the importance of that for quality of life and health. And I suppose one thing we would have looked at is how, I suppose, integral employment is in terms of a person's sense of identity. And it's one of the most important ways that people are occupied, and how they engage, I suppose, in society, how they engage with other people. And I'd love to ask, first of all, so as well as kind of training and skills, what emphasis would SpeedPAC place on things like role and re-establishing routine and that sense of purpose among the training employees?
I mean, I think it's a fundamental offering for our company is to give people that opportunity through the various programs that we recruit people under. You know, you bring somebody back immediately and they have a purpose in that they're coming to work, they're contributing, and they are also aware that they're going to be involved in training and building up maybe their CV and work experience as well. And it's important for people to feel that, particularly if you've been out of work, and particularly if you feel disconnected, that actually here's an organization that kind of wants to do something with you and wants to support you and wants to work with you. I'll give you an example of, I suppose, how our thinking evolved around this. And so we developed a concept. Now, you know, it continues to be work in progress. It's a consumer journey framework is what we called it. But the idea behind it really was that we wanted to look and think about what the experience was for people from the time, even before they heard about Speedpack, in terms of where they were at, to maybe coming to work with us and then what the ultimate outcome was going to be. And we wanted to have a think about how we could impact on that journey for those individuals. And that concept actually came from, we were fortunate back in 2010 to win an Arthur Guinness Fund Award. And that was kind of one of the first big awards at the time. There was a number of other social enterprises that have gone on to do great things like GIY, Pieta House, various other organizations at that time. But we took the concept of what their marketing team, so we got a lot of sort of input from their expertise within Diageo. And their marketing team had used this concept to, you know, convince, how do you convince a person to basically go from sitting in their house to going to the pub and having a pint? So that was the concept. So we took that concept and said to ourselves, actually, we can apply this to our setting, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to attract people in who were previously long-term unemployed. We want people to choose to come to us. And this is one of the things about an organization like ourselves, where we are supporting people who are coming in through labor market programs. A lot of the people that present to us don't feel that they're choosing to come to us. What they feel is that they've been sent. And if they don't come, that their social welfare benefit is in some way going to be affected. So we felt that what was really important to influence at an earlier stage was influence the element of choice. So what we decided to do, for example, just to give you an example, is that, so rather than people sort of coming up to us to say, you know, they might be brought up for an interview, what we did was we invited people up and we said, look, there is no obligation here. Come up. You know, one of our colleagues here will give a presentation on the company. We'll tell you what we do. We'll give you a cup of tea. We'll show you that we're actually quite friendly around here. We'll actually bring you on a tour of the facility. And then after that, if you're interested in having a further conversation, let us know and we'll set up an interview. Now, so that kind of way of dealing with people, I believe, is, you know, is a way, and certainly in terms of our kind of our values within the organization, is about respecting people. It's about the fact that, okay, people may be feeling under pressure here to sign up, but let's give people a choice that maybe we're not the right choice for them if they come in under the community employment type program. There are other options out there. But we're also sort of saying to them as well, we're interested in you and we'd like to invite you in. So, Nita, I don't know if that gives you some flavor, but that's the sort of the point at which I think it starts at the beginning of the journey. And it's the way in which we try to give a sense to people that we are a different organization and that we're interested in you and we're inviting you in. And then at different points in that journey, we try to influence and we try to think about where are the points at which we might lose people, or where are the points that we're not doing so well, and what resources do we need to point in those particular places. And it's a bit of a moving feast, because as the profile of people changes, I talked a little bit earlier on about how the economy changes and maybe the profile of long-term unemployed people might change. Well, then you have to adjust your offering and you have to point your resources differently. And as well, I suppose, there is a big reality out there that resources sometimes we might have significant resources to bear. And other times, like I suppose in the current climate, really, you know, we are cutting back like many companies to ensure that we can, you know, survive a very challenging period and be in a position then to provide the work experience and training that we know is needed now more than ever.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think what really resonates with me in what you said was that element of respect and choice. And in occupational therapy, we would very much emphasize autonomy and agency, and acknowledging that there is inevitably going to be a power dynamic between who is providing the service and who is coming to use the service. So I think that really stood out to me in your description, is that element of choice that you give people. And if you want to empower people, and if you are interested in engaging people, it has to come from them as well. They have to feel like they're autonomously making a decision. They are an agent of autonomy in this exchange.
Yes, and I think that that's down to do that kind of personal kind of contracting as well that we would have with people. And again, I should also say that, you know, one of the resources that we have within the organization is one of my colleagues is an occupational psychologist. And again, so, you know, her expertise would feed into the design of programs, or to the way in which we should be behaving, or the way in which, you know, we need to behave. And look, we are not a perfect organization. You know, there are times we do things really well. And then there are times when we are really challenged because either commercially we're under pressure or that we're tight on resources. But I think we know what is important is, I think we know what's the right way to do things. And we strive to do that. And sometimes we are more successful than others, you know.
I'm very interested, John, in the fact that when you started talking about the customer journey and you referred to the Arthur Guinness Fund, that was a fund to foster social enterprise and supported by Guinness and the Diageo Group. And it's interesting that you mentioned that they were using the customer journey, which is a tool we use in marketing to the example I use is, how do I get the customer to be interested in buying the dresses or skirts I sell, to either come into my shop or to buy them online and to wear them and to tweet them and Instagram them and so on. And it's interesting that you're using the very same marketing tool, the customer journey, in terms of, instead of bringing people from the couch at home to the pub, you're trying to bring them from the couch into SpeedPak. And that brings me to the marketing end of SpeedPak. And maybe there's a hint in the title, SpeedPak. So from your customer's point of view in trading, what does SpeedPak do?
Okay. And again, there's not quite a simple answer to this one. So I'm going to, I just try and present it to people in a way that tells our story. So yes, when we were originally founded, we were, the concept was, you know, create a company called SpeedPak, which is a contract packing business. I mean, that's what we were founded. You know, that was the business that we were going to insert people and into in terms of working within the organization. But as the company evolved, I suppose, first of all, we have a story around our social enterprise as to what, you know, our purpose. So our purpose isn't to be a packing company, okay? So our purpose is to get people who are previously long-term unemployed back into work. On our journey as well, we would have also taken on another business called Shamrock Rosettes, and we manufacture rosettes, sashes, and badges. And we do that for the equestrian clubs, agricultural shows, dog shows, and we have customized clothing as well. So that also came into the equation. And so a few years ago, and probably, you know, I think one of the things about certainly some of the awards that we've got, whether it's Rethink Ireland awards or support from the Ireland funds as well, these opportunities not only give you resources to innovate, but they also give you an opportunity to look at your organization, to look at how you're presenting yourselves, look at how you're marketing as an organization. And I think through the sort of thinking around that, we began to say to ourselves, look, we've a number of things going on here. We've got two different businesses and we've got a social enterprise voice as well. So what we did was we did a bit of a rebrand. What we did was we created, first of all, the SpeedPak Group. That is to present our social enterprise voice and gives a context for you know, the social impact that we're making, but also the businesses that we are operating. And on the on that website, speedpackgroup.com, you will find out about, you know, who we are, what we do, and as I said, provides that context and about the sort of social impact that we make and how we're governed and all of those things as well. But then we've got the two businesses, and they're two very different businesses with different customers. There was a time, I suppose, where, you know, Speedpack, the term, and I hate to even say it, but I'm going to say it just for educational purposes, you know, sheltered workshop was a concept back in the day, which has kind of well and truly kind of washed through, thankfully. But it was that sense, or if we presented ourselves as, oh, we've got long-term unemployed people working here and, you know, they're involved in the organization, businesses would have, who are looking for, you know, commercial contracts to be delivered with large volumes, to be delivered on time to a certain specification, would not have been confident in what we were doing. So therefore we said, look, we have to present ourselves to our, who our commercial customers are. I mean, if we don't have good, strong, robust commercial businesses, we don't have a work experience, an industry-led training opportunity to provide to people. So really, we have to put our efforts on ensuring that the business is good and that the business presents itself to the world the way it needs to be presented so that it is sustainable and that it's profitable and that it grows. So that's why we've got speedpack.ie, which is our Speedpack contract services, and our e-fulfillment business, which has been a new addition over the last, say, 2.5 years, the e-fulfillment business. There's two aspects to that. We provide what would be seen as standard contract packing. So if you want to get a product to market, you need something done to it. It needs to be broken down. You know, some of our customers would buy in bulk from various distributors. We'd break it down. We might shrink wrap it, barcode it, you know, assemble it, do whatever is required so that the ultimate customer can purchase it. So that's a kind of a, you know, traditional break bulk type service, as you would call it. And then we have our e-fulfillment business. And that's where we are supporting e-traders, people who are selling online, who want to just focus on sales and marketing and want everything else looked after by somebody else. And that somebody else is now us. Now, we're not up there competing against the Amazons or the distributors, but we actually do have a good USP. And that unique selling point, that unique selling point for us is the fact that we can do two elements. I'm going to give you a quick example. We've grown in terms of our commercial contract with GIY, which is another social enterprise. That's Grow It Yourself. Mick Kelly is the founder of that. Incredible social enterprise based in Waterford. Got the TV program. I'm really quite jealous of them. They're actually fantastic. But in fairness, you know, we've been working with Mick over the last number of years, and they have scaled significantly in terms of their offering. So they're selling, we're after doing a fulfillment for them for, you know, the National Libraries, 25,000 packs went out there, National Libraries, 25,000 went on to, you know, individual, this is their Grow It Forward campaign, which they ran through the lockdown. They also have a lot of B2B work where they're getting corporates who want to send out, you know, grow it your own packs, you know, so like seeds and very how to grow your own food, are sending it out to their staff who are operating remotely from home, promoting health and
feel good.
Yes, exactly. And keeping people connected and all of that. So we're doing a huge amount of work for GIY at the moment. So a lot of their products are also sold on their online shop. And so we would do all of the fulfillment work for that. So if it's sold either online or if it's sold through a corporate relationship, or it's sold through like through the delivery through the National Libraries or whatever, you know, we are doing all of that that work here. And what's brilliant about that partnership for us is, first of all, it has helped us to grow our expertise in providing that service. But what we're doing is we're matching both parts in terms of a unique selling point. We are able to manufacture the goods. So in other words, all the individual components for their grow boxes come to us, but we put them all together. Then when they're sold online, then we are storing them here, and then we are dispatching and selling those based on the orders that are coming through to their Shopify website and our Vico system, which is an e-fulfillment platform that allows us to do that fulfillment. So, and again, what's great from GIY's perspective is that they are you know, well, they're doing what they're doing, but they're actually giving us a contract, which means that they are also supporting a fellow social enterprise, which is delivering the offering that we deliver in this community. So it's a real sort of a double whammy. And what it allows us on that particular sort of commercial activity, what it allows us to do is it allows us to give a job to everybody. You see, we're providing opportunities. We're not recruiting the best people for the job. We're providing opportunities. So from day one, there has to be a job for everybody. So in that instance, if it's a job where, for example, you know, there's four items have to go into a box and the box has to be made up, four items, there might be four different seeds, there might be, you know, lollipop sticks and whatever else, containers and all those, they all have to be put together, bundled together. Now, it's a straightforward job, but it's got to be done right because people expect that, you know, whatever's in the contents you get. So there's a lot of quality control involved. It's not high tech. But the bottom line is there's a customer there paying for that and it needs to be done right. The DIY contract, it allows an opportunity for everybody who comes into the company, you know, to work in the business. I mean, as I said, you know, we provide opportunities to people. We're not employing the best people for the job. That's not what we're doing. We're getting people back into the routine of work, and we're giving people skills, some of which will be transferable skills. They may not want to work in manufacturing again, but they may move on to something else. But that DIY contract allows, on one level, to do the kitting, that sort of, we'll call it basic work, but basic but needs to be done right work, where you're putting X quantity of various components into maybe a particular grow box, and you know the sleeve has to be put on it, and everything has to be correct in it. To then, what we are hoping then to do is, you know, giving them opportunities further down, I suppose, that cycle of work, where you are looking at, you know, taking orders that are coming in directly online, where you're doing that fulfillment work, where you're, you know, linking with the, in terms of distribution and the couriers. It's at a more advanced stage where people would need to be specifically trained up in IT, and it's giving access to people to kind of 21st century skills, which is for the area where we kind of need to be pointing our sort of offering to as well. But we have to balance being able to give a job to everybody and at the same time being a viable business and be able to make profits within the business that can be reinvested back in to what we are here to achieve and the people we're here to serve.
That's very interesting. Something you said earlier on a minute there, John, is you're trying to find that balance between the transforming and training of people, and that's the social issue that you're addressing through running a business that trades like any other business. And you said, you know, we don't hire the best person for the job because that's the mission that you have with the training and transformation. So what happens to the people when you have trained them up and when they are very good at the job? Do they stay with you? Do they move on? Do you help them to move on? How does that all work?
It's a combination of all of those things, Eimear. So, I mean, obviously our role, we can't employ everybody. I mean, you know, pre-COVID, we would have been providing up to about 85 to 100 opportunities to people in any given year. So that's people who are within the organization staying for a period of time and then some moving on, others staying for a longer period. So people really would stay for a minimum of a year and anything up to 3 years. Now, the challenge for us is that we are using mechanisms of the state like labor market programs. And we don't have control of some of the criteria. In fact, we've no control, I should say, of the criteria. So therefore, because of somebody's age, they may be only entitled to 1 year on community employment. And yet that person may need 2 or 3 years. And I suppose this is a challenge. You know, it's a policy issue, really. It's about the sometimes inflexibility of programs like this. But at the same time, you know, we're thankful to have those programs because they give us the foundation to allow us to, you know, to recruit people in the first place. Again, people will stay with us for various periods of time. I mean, ideally, we want to keep people for as long as it's necessary to get them to where their ambition is in terms of a job or further education. And I suppose So we will work with people knowing what time they maybe have on the programs that we have with them. And we provide, as I said, that basic offering to people with the work experience, with the industry-led training, support then within our HR department, support in terms of building people's CVs, interview skills, and various things like that. So we will do that. There's a sort of a basic offering there. But what we do as well, I think I mentioned earlier on, is that we then go out to look for additional resources. And I think this is where we can innovate with different programs, and we can wrap more supports and more training around people. And I'll give you a couple of quick examples of that. And it kind of addresses one of the questions that you kind of raised about where do people go. And I think one of the things that we were finding back in 2014-15, we felt that we were doing a lot of training, and people were finishing with us, but they hadn't secured a job. And we were kind of saying, this is not really success from our perspective. What do we need to do differently? And I think our sense of it was that, look, we need to be training people, not just for training's sake, but training for a purpose. And so we felt then that we needed to start looking at getting a better pipeline of opportunities for people with industry partners in the area. And we were fortunate enough then to actually, it came from an introduction through, this is just part of the ecosystem, Social Entrepreneurs Ireland. Darren Ryan was the CEO at the time. And he made an introduction for me with JP Morgan. And JP Morgan actually were running a program called New Skills at Work. And the concept behind New Skills at Work was that actually a lot of people are going to college and coming out of college, but it was felt that a lot of people who were where the jobs were available didn't need a kind of college degree. And I know I shouldn't be saying this in a college environment, but it was about this kind of the further education sector. Now, what really people needed was not everybody needs to go to college, or certainly not immediately. And that the routes to education, training, and lifelong learning are all very, very different now. So it's kind of said, look, what really people need are skills that are relevant to the sector and the job that they're going into. And so we said, well, look, we can do something about this. And we developed what was known as an enhanced skills program. And the concept behind it, I mean, not rocket science here, but what we said was that, look, let's bring together a number of companies that are in the area that are big employers. So we approached IKEA, Real Time Technologies, Bewley's Tea and Coffee, Butlers, who are based here as well in the estate, Allergan or AbbVie, who are one of our corporate sponsors. And we said, look, would you be willing to get involved in the program here? What we're going to do here is we're going to, you know, first of all, we asked and we did a sort of a profiling of what the needs were for, you know, entry level people coming into their organization. And based on that sort of occupational type skills profiling, we built an offering and a program, a curriculum. And that curriculum was centered around just giving people really just working on kind of personal development stuff, but around, you know, health and safety, forklift license training, first aid responder training, and then specific skills in the area that we looked at, which was manufacturing and logistics. So we bought in a course based around that. We ran this program for 30 people over 2 years. We ran it with small groups because we had the investment from JP Morgan and with support from AbbVie Allergan group as well. And of the 30 people, they all got work experience placements within those organizations. 24 of the 30 secured a job at the end of the program, which is, you know, 80%. And over 50% of people got a job within the organization that we had partnered with as well. So we learned from that and we felt that this was, you know, this works, but you do need additional resources. And this is one of the things, we don't always have the resources to do this sort of stuff. It does require, this is where we get the real kind of through the collaboration, through investment and social investment, we generate additional revenues, which we can plow back in. And that led then, that concept led with further work with Cláiste de Dulig, which is the local college here, to us developing using the same and bringing the same industry cluster together, the first traineeship in manufacturing, supply chain and customer service logistics, a bit of a mouthful, but in the city of Dublin ETB. We ran two of the traineeships here, then COVID came along and we weren't in a position to do it anymore. And now Colossia Dulig are running it independently. We see what the need is. We look for resources. We try to build an offering. We try to sustain it for as long as we can. And it has often led to improving our practice as well.
That's interesting. It strikes me that that training program in conjunction with the local major employers, which has eventually become a training course in Collège de Bouli, which would provide further education courses. In a way, that's your classic social innovation and a spin-off, to use entrepreneurship language, that you innovated with a new training course, provided the real experience in a real live industrial business setting, and spun it off over to Colossia de Bouli.
I think probably fair to say that they were in control of the traineeship, because the traineeships are developed by the education and training boards, and they had been thinking along those lines themselves. But I think what it enabled us to do was to collaborate, for them to plug into our employer network, for us to target people who we were used to working with, who are long-term unemployed people. We provided something different in the sense that a number of the trainees on the traineeship program, you know, would get work experience here in Speedpack first before we would send them out to industry, because again, you know, work needed to be done with people before they could go out to industry partners. And we wanted those people to have the best opportunity maybe to secure a job or something like that, once they had the opportunity to go out to that employer. So, yeah, I mean, look, it is certainly social innovation in that sense. But I think it's also very much about, you know, our success is built around ultimately around our collaborations that we forge. You know, we're not all of our successes have always come from partnerships through, as I said, philanthropy, CSR, I suppose the contribution of individuals and people giving of their time to us as well. So that's very much how we're built as an organization. And it's also really how our income is sort of derived from this combination, this, you know, of which makes us very different from a regular business. It comes from our commercial businesses. It comes from the contracts that we have with the state. Now, the state refers to these often as grants. I hate that, because I don't feel it's a grant. It's not. You're not giving us money. We're providing a service. We are taking on X number of people who are long-term unemployed. It is a contract for service. That's what it is. And then we're also getting philanthropy, as I said, and CSR, and supporting other organizations give back to the communities that they are operating in or have an interest in terms of supporting people as well. So,
yeah. So that's interesting, because I was about to ask you if you're at liberty to share with us the commercial information of what percentage of the income comes from the pure trading, and if you are very good, if it's something that's a commercial secret, what would you say to a private sector organization that says, well, we provide packaging services and fulfillment as well, and we don't get all those grants?
Well, first of all, yeah, in terms of our, you know, commercial sales, I mean, we publish our accounts, so it's there for everybody, you know, to see in terms of how we make our money. And I suppose this comes down to the definition as to what you consider to be sales income. So if you're looking at our commercial businesses, pure commercial businesses in terms of Speedpack Contract Services and Shamrock Rosettes, I mean, over the last number of years, that has been anything between just under 40% to up as high as 50% in terms of our overall income. But if you look at our overall income, there's a high percentage of our overall income comes from grants from government, as they call it, or which are actually in the form of people's social welfare payment. And I think that's sort of, you know, you bundle that together and you sort of say, oh, that's how much income you're getting. But that's not really, that's just money just being passed from the state to us, which we pass on to people, which they would have got as part of their social welfare payment. So I just think there are nuances here, which I think you need to kind of get a flavor of When you look at that. So we are looking at around anywhere between 40 and 50%, depending on how the economy is performing. And I suppose to answer then the other question about, well, you know, where does that leave us vis-a-vis other companies that might be doing similar work to us as a contract packing company? When we were set up originally, the reason we were set up was because there was no contract packer in the area. There was no contract packing company. So there was an actual need for a contract packing business. In fact, Cadbury or Mondelez used to have to send product abroad to get contract packed to be brought back. So in the beginning, there was a commercial need for this business to be set up, and there was a market need to be done. Now, if somebody comes along tomorrow and sets up beside us and then says that we are getting government contracts, well, I'm sorry, but the arguments I'd be using would be, for example, there's been no business that hasn't had some sort of intervention from the state. If you look at all of the interventions that to the business community that have come through COVID, there's a level playing field out there. The other thing is that we're taking on, if people are also happy to take on people who are long-term unemployed into their business and give them work experience and training on behalf of the state, so that we can make it an equal level playing field, well, then let's compete at that basis. But we're delivering something on behalf of the state. And because of that, what we're doing is we're adding value, because actually we're out there generating income. We're getting people to contribute who were previously long-term unemployed. And we are generating income that goes back to the exchequer. I mean, we collect VAT and we pay because of the goods and services that we deliver. And we are also adding value in terms of the work experience and training. So one of our programs was called our workplace accreditation model, and that was the reason we won the Arthur Guinness Fund Award for. But the concept behind that at the time was about how could we convert workplace learning into an educational qualification, because a lot of the people that we were working with didn't have a leaving cert. So we used what became known as it went from FETAC to QQI. We used that framework and those modules, and we built modules based on the workplace, and we got people up to a stage where they were able to get 8 level 4 at the time FETAC awards, which gave them the equivalent of a leaving certificate. So we're using innovation, we're adding value. What's the cost to the state to give people the equivalent of a leaving certificate? And we know what the cost is for that. Likewise, we know what the cost is for keeping people out of prison. And we again would have research done in the company on the numbers of prisoners that we have, or people who had a previous criminal conviction who worked in our organization. And it's this kind of notion of preventative spend. So what we've done is we know that there's 70% recidivism, or people who will go back into prison after a set period of time. And we were able to demonstrate that over a 3-year period, that of the 10 people that we had here, nobody went back into prison. And again, what's the saving to the state by not having to house somebody as well? So, you know, it's challenging for a small company to be presenting itself and to be capturing this information and to be able to convince people. But it's what we have to do, because this is what makes us different as an organization. And this is what gives us purpose. And this is what allows us to give opportunities to people who ordinarily may not get those opportunities presented to them.
That's a very interesting. And before we come back to some questions to do with higher education, I'd like to go back to tie two things together. Number one, you talked about grow it yourself and the contract you got from another social enterprise. And it strikes me that there's a whole ecosystem out there that nearly operates in parallel to the for-profit sector. And back to how you count the money, or how you count the value for money and I suppose finance. There's a whole landscape out there as well of social finance. So I'm wondering, have ye ever had to get loans from the bank to do what you want to do, or have you chosen social finance? And for our listeners, you might explain what your understanding of social finance sure. might be.
Look, every business needs access to finance. You know, I mean, you know, to first of all, to start off, to grow your business and to have cash flow. Cash flow is, you know, cash is king in every business. So yes, we would have at this point and over the years, you know, I suppose two main arrangements. The first is that we would have our main banking facilities with Bank of Ireland, and we would have overdraft facilities in place for times when we need that due to cash flow that we can project when we need extra facilities in place. But we would also then access social finance. So one of the companies that we would have social finance from would be Clan Credo. There are two providers of kind of retail facing social finance in Ireland, Community Finance Ireland being the other one. And what that allows us to do is it allows us to talk to a lender who really understands what we're trying to do and who lend into, I suppose, a number of sectors you would call the community and voluntary sector being one, the social enterprise sector being another, but are there to support and lend into organizations that have a social purpose and have a need for social finance. Now, the reality is that they are willing to, I suppose, to talk to all organizations around that. So they will talk and engage and support organizations to help them to ensure that, you know, that they are asking for the right level maybe of resources and that in fact that they have the capacity to pay it. I mean, they are there to make money as well. They are a social enterprise in themselves. So they have to be able to make money to continue to lend out into the sector. So we've been very fortunate at times. So say, for example, if we wanted to buy capital expenditure items in our commercial entity, that we wanted to be able to, you know, upgrade our facilities in some way, if we wanted to use it as match funding. So sometimes there are opportunities that you can get grants from government if you can show that you can match fund it with your own resources as well. And that's why the social lending aspect is fantastic in that respect. So yeah, that has been hugely beneficial. And again, it is part of that. You've talked about an ecosystem. That finance bit is part of the ecosystem. Social enterprises doing business with each other. I think there's a bit of that, Eimear. But I think the reality is that a lot of social enterprises want to be able to offer their businesses and services to everybody. You know, if it so happens to be within the social enterprise space, because you know, if you can support somebody in that space, I think you'll do it because, you know, again, it's meeting your own mission in a way or your own values as an organization. And I think that will grow as more social enterprises begin to be more outwardly looking and market themselves better and promote themselves better. And as the sector itself gets promoted, I mean, as you know, there was a social enterprise policy was launched back in 2019. It was actually launched here from SpeedPAC by Minister Ring. Now that policy is coming to an end. You know, it's a 3-year policy. And there has been certainly some progress there, but there's a lot more work to be done in terms of communicating what social enterprises are about and supporting social enterprises. As I said, there has been, you know, some work done, but there's more to do.
Yeah, and just yes, going back, I suppose, to what you were saying, Eimear, about an ecosystem, one thing that we have really seen is in terms of, I suppose, looking at social innovation and social entrepreneurship is the emphasis on transdisciplinarity and interdisciplinarity, both within social enterprises themselves, but even I think what really stood out to me about you saying, you know, that collaboration with GIY is that actually between social enterprises, there's also that transdisciplinary collaboration and transdisciplinary support that has enabled, I suppose, the further success of these entities and these organizations.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's true. And I think that we would have known each other through the networking that we would do. And that networking would come about because we would often be involved maybe in the same programs or we would have gone for the same competitions, you know, that are there, and we would have got to know each other. And then you begin to have conversations. And actually that's kind of where it came from. I suppose at the end of the day, you've got to be able to provide, you can have those deeper connections when your businesses are more aligned with each other and are close, you know, that there's a purpose for you from a commercial perspective to be working with each other. I mean, for example, Sensational Kids is another social enterprise that we have a contract with. And they provide a whole range of services to kids with particular needs. And they have training to support teaching of kids in those contexts. And they run the training, and like we do the fulfillment work for all of the training packs that would go out to all of the to all of those trainers. Now, again, that connection has come about through meeting with Sensational Kids and knowing them and them knowing us. And Karen, who's the CEO there and founder, myself and Karen are on a representative organization which we have found, which was Social Enterprise Republic of Ireland, which is there to represent the sector to, in terms of social enterprises, to give a voice for the sector. Tammy Darcy is the CEO of Social Enterprise Republic of Ireland, and Tammy is the founder of the Shona Project. Again, another really successful, a really successful organization as well. So there's a lot of more collaboration happening between us. And again, I just think it's a very exciting time to be involved in social enterprise.
Speaking of training and education, John, you're a graduate of Dublin City University yourself. So you have experience of DCU. You might let us know, you know, what you studied in DCU, and obviously it's a while ago. I'm interested as well in what advice you would give to higher level educators who are beginning to implement or to embed the concepts of social innovation and entrepreneurship in their teaching. And I'm thinking right across the board in DCU, you know, or in any higher education institution in Ireland or abroad, doesn't matter what the discipline might be, it might be history, it might be politics, it might be chemistry or whatever. So number one, why? What advice would you have for them, and just tell us a little bit about your own links.
Sure, I suppose maybe I'll answer the second one first. So I did a, I went and did an education training management first. It was a certificate course. I was just interested in it, and I got involved in it because I was doing some voluntary work with the Ballymun Reading and Writing Scheme, and I was sort of interested. I'd moved into the commercial world for about 10 years and with Coca-Cola bottlers and Bass Brewers, but I actually graduated as a teacher originally, and then I went into the, you know, went into a different world, and then was always interested in that space. So I did the cert and then was really interested in that, and then I went and did the Master's in Education and Training Management, which was a great experience. I really enjoyed my time there, and met a lot of really interesting people on the course as well. So that was a good foundation for me in terms of kind of being able to marry my, you know, kind of commercial experience with an understanding of education and training. And I suppose to some extent, you know, a good fit for where I currently am and have been for a good number of years. I suppose, you know, from the academic world and what sort of advice would I give? I don't think this is going to be rocket science, but I think it's some very practical things. I think things like, I think to understand, you know, there's the, I'm sure academics are, you know, there's the theory and then there's the practice. And I think it's actually one of the things about actually remembering in my time in DCU is about this action, kind of action research model that really appeals to me. Because I think it appeals to me because I certainly learn by doing, and we make mistakes, and it's about our capacity to kind of interrogate, analyze, and sort of move on. So I like that approach as a way in which to learn anyway. But I think kind of visiting social enterprises, we're talking here today and you're getting maybe a sense and a feel for who we are. We'd often invite groups at pre-COVID time to come up and we bring you around. And I think you really get a sense of the place. You get a feel for the place, and you get a deeper understanding as to how these places operate. And I think as well, if you're talking about social enterprises, they come in all shapes and sizes and all sorts of flavors. And you know, we talk about, and those of us in the sector, we are talking about it as a sector. Some people don't think it is. Some people think it's a, you know, it's part of the community and voluntary space, but it's not. Some may have come from that, but really we are businesses. We operate a social enterprise as businesses with a purpose. You know, we're there to deliver a social mission, but we've got to have that kind of commercial kind of front end in terms of what we are doing. So we're not a homogenous group, and there's lots of differences in terms of some have big scale, like the food clouds and, you know, the GIYs and that are national organizations, Sensational Kids, My Mind, and then there's local providers, which we would be. And it's not to say you couldn't take the speech pack concept and put it somewhere else. You could, but it would require maybe, you know, I suppose maybe a different approach for us to do that. But you've got lots of other than local players who are providing something local within their community. So I think it's understanding that sort of landscape. It's understanding the fact that our metrics and how we capture information is all very different. Some is all about scale and about reach and about, and others are about maybe providing it to fewer people, but having deeper supports. There's a variety there. So I think that, yeah, I think for those in the space of teaching and informing and maybe trying to encourage people, I think, you know, reach out to those organizations that are in your community, bring people out there, get a feel for it, invite them in to talk about their organization. And then try and apply some of that learning and see, you know, again, to make it very real. I think you're doing a lot of that sort of stuff is done. You do tend to organize visits, but I think it shouldn't be lost that these things are important, to make it real and to bed it down. And in fact, then to have a debate about, well, what's the theory or what's the great way? What way should it be maybe? And what way is it? And why are the differences there? You know, so I think that would be certainly some thoughts on that.
And thank you for that. And so that's for the teachers on the one hand, or lecturers and professors on the one hand. The name of our project is From Passion to Action. And it's about helping students to go from being passionate about some issue that they care about, be it an environmental issue or a social issue, to acting and having some kind of an impact. So what advice would you give directly to students who want to do something about a social issue that or environmental issue that they care about?
Well, the first thing is, if you can follow your passion and you really are passionate about it, you will undoubtedly have more success because you really believe in what you are doing. And it's okay, it may not always be possible, but I think you should give it the best go that you certainly can. But I think you've got to do, but the reality is that, look, there's a lot of issues that are out there that sometimes other people are solving. So I think you've got to do your research as well. I mean, and if you're interested in pursuing something, you've got to find out, is there anyone else doing it? Maybe not only in this jurisdiction, but in other jurisdictions as well. So I think, you know, probably like any business, if you're setting it up or you're thinking about following something, a passion, and you want to make a change, and maybe you're thinking about that you've just set something up, you really got to do your research. Find out who's out there. Find out, are there, like, not everybody is the entrepreneur. Not everybody is the one who's going to set up the company. I didn't set up this company. I was fortunate to be able to come in and maybe add value in different ways into the organization. So not everybody is going to set a company up. That may be your ambition, but maybe your ambition is also just to work in an organization. So if you want to work in an organization, show interest in that organization. Write to them. Think about how you might present yourself to them. You know, it might be an opportunity to get work experience. Offer yourself as somebody to say, look, I've got some time here. Get a bit of insight into that organization. You know, there's lots of ways to be creative about, you know, first of all, identifying who might be, or get more experience in the issue or issues that relate to it. And I think, you know, okay, it's kind of tricky. It can be hard for like all social enterprises to take people on work experience as well. You know, I'm not talking about in terms of our core purpose, but to bring other people in. But there are lots of organizations who would, you know, very, very much welcome that. And it could be an opportunity for somebody, for somebody who's thinking along those lines, to get experience or to see how an organization that they think is really good works, or to get some insights into a particular space that there's good touch points off it and that they want maybe to learn more, or might help them to decide if they're going down the right path, or do they need to kind of regroup and maybe to consider. So I think, and be open to asking for advice for people as well, or just picking up the phone. I mean, I've had over the years lots of calls from people just asking me about, you know, what do you do there, or we heard about SpeedPak, or somebody said, or I'm interested in this, and just sort of, you know, don't be afraid to ask. Now, not everybody's in a position to say yes, but you've got to ask and be open to do that as well. So I think those sorts of things, follow your passion, do your research, Look for opportunities where there are touch points to, you know, to maybe further your ambition, and don't be afraid to ask as well.
Well, that's great advice for the students, John. Thank you for reminiscing about your own time in DCU when you were doing the Masters in Education and Training Management. And it's great that you're recommending to students that they engage with the sector, engage with social enterprises, not to be afraid to reach out like that. Because I think there's great value to be got from just even following the social enterprise through Twitter, through the social media. Networking, I think, is another thing, you know, in terms of seeing what's happening in that very active social enterprise landscape that you've mentioned to us.
Yeah, I give a big kind of a plug to Social Enterprise Republic of Ireland and to Tammy Darcy. But again, I would say there's a great resource there that has been built up. We've got a fantastic practitioners council there, which has on it, I think, 15, you know, leading social enterprises practitioners in there who are all giving of their time in terms of, you know, pulling together what are the issues for the sector at the moment and looking at really constructive ways in which maybe to influence policy or to highlight, you know, what social enterprise is about and where to go to next. We've got a lot of very ambitious plans there being led by Tammy and her team. So I think as well, that's another place for students to contact, is to contact Social Enterprise Republic of Ireland, and somebody will get back to you and hopefully point you in the right direction. And we're looking at ways of even to connect people with experienced social enterprise practitioners as well, because we want to encourage, you know, people with ideas, young or old, who have a belief in something that's going to make a difference in our society and that is following the model of social enterprise.
Okay. You've given us a huge amount of your time, John. It shows how truly and deeply passionate you are about the work that you're doing, and certainly plenty of action and progress in the work that you're doing. So I really thank you very much today for having this conversation with me and with Mida in our series From Passion to Action. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Emer, and thanks, Mida.
Thank you for listening to the From Passion to Action podcast. If you'd like to find out more about John's work at SpeedPack Group, you can visit their website at speedpackgroup.com.